All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Now we are shifting our focus pretty much exclusively over to the metals sector, resources, commodities, as we are chatting with Matt Geiger. Matt is the managing partner at MJG Capital, runs a fund that is focused on investing in, let's say, junior to mid-tier companies in the resource space. We always get Matt's insights on what he's doing within the fund's portfolio and his thought on these broad markets. So, Matt, it's been a little while since we last chatted. It was the end of February. That was our last conversation. And boy, oh boy, a lot has happened in the world, in these markets, and out of the U.S. over that time. A lot dealing with tariffs, geopolitical issues that has caused a lot of volatility in the markets, but it really has benefited the precious metals, especially gold and the gold stocks. Gold stocks are doing very well right now. Let's just start off with a bit of a recap, your takeaway from Liberation Day, the new tariff regime, how this is all filtering into all of us investors that are invested in the metal space.
Well, the world has certainly changed since we last chatted, Corey, so good to be with you. And I mean, I am pleased to say that the MJG portfolio is up sharply on the month, but boy, has it been a stressful couple of weeks. I feel like I've aged a couple years since Liberation Day alone. And really those four or five trading days immediately after Liberation Day were a real gut check for anybody participating in the mining space, let alone the junior space. But obviously things have improved quite markedly. Even if you just look over the past five or six trading days, it's been day after day of substantial gains within the portfolio. I will say from a very high level, tariffs are a mixed bag for those of us with mining exposure. So let's just put gold to the side for the time being. But for the rest of the metals complex, tariffs are going to reduce global GDP and hence global demand for metals, plain and simple. The U.S. effective tariff rate on imports was roughly 2.5% last year. We'll say 3% in the previous regime. This, of course, jumped to 27% in terms of the tariffs that Trump announced on Liberation Day. But even with his subsequent decision to reduce reciprocal tariffs across the board ex-China, we're still at 22.5%, 23% effective tariff rate when reflecting the subsequent increases to the China-specific rate. So we haven't seen a jump of this overall magnitude in terms of tariff in the United States, going all the way back to literally the 1860s. And I would argue with the U.S. in the very center of the global economy, anybody that doesn't believe this is going to have a significant effect on global economic growth and hence metal demand is deluding themselves. So that is one side of the coin. The other more positive side of the coin is that I'm increasingly convinced that Trump has single-handedly ended the nearly 17-year run of U.S. equities, basically trouncing any other asset class globally. So I would argue the era of U.S. stocks outperforming emerging and international equities, you know, new economy stocks outperforming the old economy, growth outperforming value, I would argue this is over. And as a result, there will be literally trillions of dollars of capital that has been served very well in recent years, just resting in the S&P 500, looking for a new home over the coming months and years. And at least based on the price action we've seen so far, this new home is unlikely to be in U.S. dollars or U.S. treasuries. So this will be to the benefit of the very asset classes that have been trounced by U.S. equities, really since the great financial crisis. So I do see this as exceedingly bullish for commodities, emerging market equities as well. I would say international equities more broadly in the years ahead. So again, it is a mixed bag, but I think at least over the medium term, this will prove to be a net positive for those of us with natural resource exposure. But of course, buckle up because there's going to be significant volatility in the weeks and months ahead.
Well, Matt, you said it, man. I mean, it's definitely changing the script of U.S. equities dominance and the place of commodities. There's even been a lot of executive orders dealing specifically with critical minerals, with copper, even a second critical minerals one that just dropped in the last week. And we can't ignore the one commodity or, I guess, monetary asset that you put to the side, which is gold. I'd love you to get you just to weigh in on the move in gold. It seems like as the sole safe haven, people used to turn to bonds. They would turn to the U.S. dollar. There seems to be a real shunning of U.S. assets in favor of piling into gold as the safe haven globally in almost every currency on the planet. What's your take on the breakaway train that is gold?
Well, you put it well there, Shad. I mean, it really is the only game in town for investors that are looking for a safe haven, at least since Liberation Day, and things may well change. But the U.S. financial markets are behaving more like an emerging economy would, where we're not seeing that traditional flight to safety to the U.S. dollar or to U.S. treasuries that we've seen going back many decades in similar circumstances of uncertainty. And gold has reaped the benefits of that. I mean, heck, the gold price is up 27% year to date as we speak. That equals the performance of 2024, which was a phenomenal year for the gold price, also 27%, the greatest annual gain in that asset going back to 2010. So we've already replicated the 2024 results in just over a quarter. And, you know, I've said this on this program before, I'll say it again here. We've come a long way very fast. So again, of course, the market does not heed to my wishes or desires, but I would not mind at all for the gold price to hang out and even, you know, pull back to 3,000 and just consolidate there for 6, 9, 12 months and give us a breather. Because if I could have my way, we don't have a blow off top here, you know, 6 or 9 months down the line. And this, you know, move in gold can be longer lasting into the later stages of this decade. So we will see how that plays out.
Matt, with all these tariffs, then tying that back into maybe investing themes in individual companies, how important is where projects are located right now, taking into account that geopolitical risk?
Yeah, I mean, I would say at least from the MJG portfolio perspective, I'm more tolerant of geopolitical risk than most investors that are out there. It's the right team. It's an exceptional project. You're paying a fair or discounted price. I think as long as you don't put too many of your eggs in any given basket, over time, that's the right way to approach things. So certainly one has to reassess in light of the decision-making that's coming out of Washington. But as it stands, I haven't made any major decisions in terms of portfolio allocation. And so we're sticking with the jurisdictions that we have exposure to and not making any knee-jerk reactions, that's for sure.
Well, Matt, just one more factor to bring into this is, in addition to different countries, specifically China and the U.S. having some the trade tariffs, trade wars going back and forth, the other comment we've heard is that maybe China is liquidating their treasuries and that's how they're going to get back. But that doesn't make sense mathematically because they wouldn't be able to roll that money into anything else paying as high of a yield. It seems like China's approach has been to use export bans on a lot of other minerals, things like tungsten and antimony, rare earths, germanium. So there's a lot of those critical minerals that they're putting export bans on. And that's caused a lot of companies in the resource sector to focus on finding more of those or highlighting those in their portfolio. Have you seen any trends in the market or in your own portfolio as it relates to critical minerals as a result of these Chinese export bans?
Yeah, well, that has been a big story, really going back to the later stages of the Biden administration. You know, I would say, especially at PDAC, antimony and tungsten were particularly topical. And then, of course, with China's move just on Sunday afternoon, at least Pacific time, you know, further ratcheting up their rare earth export bans to also include magnets that contain rare earths, that's become very topical. And we're going to see articles flowing out about that particular decision for the next couple weeks. So certainly on the top of investors' minds. You know, Perpetua Resources is an interesting company. I would argue that they're through and through a gold play. If you look at the percentage of revenue that is expected to come from their antimony byproduct, it's, you know, close to, you know, probably 6 or 7% at current prices. So it's a gold play through and through, but they've been able to effectively use their antimony byproduct as a way to accelerate permitting and also receive significant quantities of financial support, both from the U.S. military and then more recently from the Export-Import Bank. So I think companies can wisely, if they have byproduct exposure to some of these critical minerals, even if it doesn't have a huge impact on their overall project economics, they should follow the Perpetua model and see if it can help streamline their permitting process and get some urgency around getting that project fully permitted and across the finish line. We're also, of course, seeing, you know, a few companies do spin outs of projects that are being branded as more antimony focused. Liberty Gold is one example of that. We also have a holding within the MJG portfolio. I shouldn't say yet, but I think they're probably working on doing a tungsten focused spin out themselves. So lots going on that front. And we can also touch on rare earths a little bit as well.
Let's go to rare earths then, or really anything else in terms of these executive orders, in terms of the U.S. seemingly to be more interested in developing some domestic supply. However, again, I think the market still does wait to see some deals getting signed, some funding coming in. So any other, I guess, different metals that do have your attention in terms of an investment angle?
Yeah, I mean, I think it'll be interesting to your audience, and this will be a KE report exclusive because this is not a name that I've discussed publicly. It's one that's been in the portfolio for maybe 18 to 24 months at this point. But on Monday, we added pretty significantly to our Neo Performance Materials position, which is our only rare earth focused investment within the MJG portfolio. Neo is the only Western company globally with the capacity to do all of the following: separate rare earth concentrates into rare earth oxides, take those rare earth oxides and reduce them further into rare earth metals, turn those rare earth metals into rare earth alloys, and then take those rare earth alloys and manufacture them into powder and now sintered magnets. So it's basically a one-stop shop for the entire rare earth value chain, absent the first step, which is, of course, mining. And as some of your listeners probably know, at this point, 40% of global rare earth mining is now conducted by non-Chinese parties outside of China. So that's a very significant change from where we were during the last rare earth mania, you know, in the 2009 to 2011 time period. So the world as a whole has actually reduced its dependence on China quite significantly as it pertains to that very first step, which is mining. The problem, of course, is that 90% of the necessary following steps, the separation, the reduction into metals, the alloyization, is occurring within China, and then China's also producing 90% plus of global permanent magnet supply that contain rare earths. So they do still have a stranglehold on the supply chain as a whole, just less so on the mining front. And so on Monday, when I woke up and saw companies like MP Materials and then earlier stage companies with US-based assets, you know, trading up 20 to 45% in one case on the news that came out of China on Sunday, and I saw NIO had only moved by 5%. It really did seem like a fat pitch to increase our position sizing. As I do think the market is fundamentally misunderstanding how the rare earth supply chain actually functions, and our continued reliance on China, not on the mining front, but in all the necessary following steps needed to make a magnet. And as mentioned, NIO is the only group in the Western world that can do all of those steps. And I think they're an extremely strategically significant company that is simply not getting its due amongst the broader investment community.
Well, Matt, I really appreciate you making that a KER exclusive here today. And yeah, that's a company that's been around for a while. In fact, at one point, they were folded into Molycorp in the prior cycle and then both spun out separately again to form MP Materials and NIO Performance in this cycle. So they have all that downstream. And I think you're right. A lot of investors in our space focus only on the mining stocks, but they're not looking downstream at all the processing and separation you need with rare earths. There are a few other companies working on those, but it doesn't get as much airtime. So I really appreciate you putting a highlight on the rare earth sector. Let's widen the scope, though, for you, Matt. In the MJG Capital portfolio, in light of all of these moves and all of the commodities, are there any other changes you're making inside of the portfolio?
Sure. Well, I've mentioned NIO, of course. I would say we've been quite active, actually, since we last spoke, you know, maybe 5 or 6 weeks ago. Probably the most noteworthy piece of news is that we've actually initiated our first new position. This was last month, going all the way back to June of last year when we participated in the Corex copper financing. So until this most recent investment, it had been a good 7 or 8 months since we'd added a new name to the MJG portfolio. So that's exciting. I am not willing to share the name of this new investment as it's still under accumulation as it pertains to the fund. But from a high level, it's a sub $20 million junior that holds an equity portfolio that essentially covers the company's entire market cap. And then with that, you get multiple gold assets for free, owned 100% by the company, but there's one in particular that's particularly interesting. So we did initiate this position when it was trading at a discount to the value of the equity portfolio. So it had a negative enterprise value at that time. It subsequently had a pretty nice rally in the week since. So it does have a positive enterprise value of, you know, $1.5 million or $2 million at the moment. But for all intents and purposes, you get the company's 100% owned gold assets for free. So that's the newest, you know, broad strokes, that's the newest name that we've added to the portfolio. Otherwise, we've trimmed a couple positions, you know, by 10, 20% each. Nothing serious, just to free up some cash. And we've also started the process of liquidating an underperformer at a loss, unfortunately. I guess some spring cleaning, so to speak. But I imagine it will take a number of months for us to complete that process realistically, because the name is very illiquid.
Matt, broadly, are you just seeing a lot of opportunities out there with stocks, a lot of these stocks moving higher? I know people are still somewhat disappointed at some of the action, especially in the juniors, but I'm seeing a lot of stocks leveraging the gold price move and breaking to either 52-week highs, some even to all-time highs. Do you see just a wealth of opportunities out there? Or is it still very a selective game for you?
Well, it's always a selective game, but there opportunities certainly abound. I will say, though, we're sitting pretty tight with our current portfolio. I mean, maybe we'd add another name by the end of Q2, but I would put the odds of that at less than 50-50. And I'm comfortable with the 18 positions that we hold within the portfolio as it stands. Two of those are private, so 16 of those are publicly traded. So largely sitting tight. And if I see companies rally closer to or well above what I view fair or expected value, I'll take profits, if not sell entirely. And if I see stories, you know, NEO being one example, that I don't think are getting their due relative to the rest of the portfolio, I'll take action accordingly. But as it stands, I mean, we're pretty much fully deployed. We have a low single digit cash position as it stands. So not a huge amount of capacity to go out there and, you know, add another two or three names, at least in the near term here.
Well, Matt, another point we should highlight is that in addition to more funds finally getting some inflows, in addition to retail investors finally getting into some of these stocks, even generalists possibly getting into some of the gold stocks for the first time in a long time, we also see insiders getting into their own stocks. So maybe break down some of the data you had to share with us today about insider buying.
We do. I think this is a really interesting phenomenon that I haven't seen too many people speaking about as of yet. So high level, I mean, the TSX Venture is up 7% year to day as we speak. And this on its own is somewhat remarkable. I mean, I think most would argue that we're in what can fairly be described as a risk-off environment. And yet the venture is outperforming the, you know, Toronto main board, the TSX, by 9% year to date. And it's outperforming the S&P by 16 or 17% year to date. So the outperformance of the TSXV as more of a speculative index is remarkable in its own right. But coming back to the insider buying, typically in a period of strong share price action, like we've seen in the TSX Venture, you'll see roughly a one-to-one ratio, if not a negative ratio, in terms of companies with net insider buying relative to net insider selling. So again, typically in periods where the TSXV is rallying, you'll see at best a one-to-one ratio between net insider buying and net insider selling. But as it stands, this is not what we're seeing today. The latest figures that I've come across, and this is from Inc. Research, is that, and this is looking at their insider sentiment indicator, is that it's currently above 400%. So in other words, four companies on the TSX Venture are experiencing net insider buying for everyone that's experiencing net insider selling. Again, highly anomalous in a period where the TSX's price action has been very strong. And it's a similar story for the miners as well. If you look at the miners listed on the TSX main board, the sentiment indicator is at roughly 190% for gold miners specifically on the TSX. So that's 1.9 companies experiencing insider buying for everyone that's experienced selling. And if you look at the diversified miners, that indicator is closer to 350%. So I would argue this is an acutely positive sign for the whole space, really from the seniors down to the smallest of the juniors. And I will say we're also seeing the same phenomenon playing out within the MJG portfolio. I'd say the two shining examples would be Lara Exploration and, you know, the aforementioned Corex Copper. Regarding Lara, and I noted this on social media earlier this week, we've seen literally 31 different insider transactions over the past 60 days between four different insiders, including the chairman, Miles Thompson, and the CEO, Simon Ingram. And I mean, we've held Lara shares for over 5 years at this point, and I've never seen anything like it in terms of insider activity from the key players, which already own close to 20% of the company. So skin in the game was never an issue there, and now it's even less of an issue. And for Corex, which was featured as the featured investment in the most recent MJG partnership letter, we're seeing similar activity, maybe not quite to the same degree. We've seen 9 different open market purchases since the beginning of the year between 3 key insiders, including the CEO, Haya Don, and the new exec chairman, Alan Friedman. So it's really hard not to have your spirits buoyed, you know, as a shareholder when you see management really putting their money where their mouth is to this degree.
Matt, do you think this lowers the risk profile of some of these juniors then? Because it is still the sector or the part of this sector that some investors are waiting for. Even though these juniors sometimes don't even have assets, a lot of money does focus on these juniors saying, when are they going to start to move now that we're seeing more insider buying? Is that, obviously it's positive, but sometimes we see insider buying that simply just supports a share price. Now could it further drive the share price higher?
Yeah, perhaps. You know, again, that's a very extreme skew at over 4 to 1. So I would argue it's a positive for this for the junior space as a whole, undoubtedly. I don't know if I would describe it as, you know, lowering the risk profile, because again, all investors should go into this with the assumption that 80% of the juniors out there are gonna lose money over time if not go to zero. So you still got to be as selective as ever. But if one is, you know, looking at initiating a company or a position on the open market, look at the recent insider activity. In some of the cases, these companies may need to raise in the relatively near future. So that's another thing to look at, of course, insider participation in upcoming financings. So some groups where we maybe haven't seen insider buying to date, we may see a financing in the next month or two. And then the thing to look at there would be how much of the financing, if any, is being taken down by the insiders. So this is, in its own right, is not a reason whatsoever to buy a given company's share. But for me, people are at the very top of the list in terms of the variables that one should look at when considering an investment. And you want to see skin in the game. And if you see buying, I mean, as the saying goes, there's really only one reason for these insiders to buy. So that really firmly checks the people box in certain circumstances. And then one can get onto the other variables as you consider whether to invest or not.
Yeah, Matt, such a great point. There's lots of reasons to sell, but only one reason to buy. So nice to see that insider buying. Let's talk about the other side of this equation, though, which we haven't really had to cover in years, and that is, when do you sell? And the question I want to ask you is, as a fund manager, you already alluded to trimming a little bit back on a couple of positions that have been running, but we're going to get to the point where some of these stocks have gone up multiple fold, and people have to make a decision on whether they want to horse trade one company for another if they see other interesting opportunities. As a fund manager, how do you decide when to sell out of a position? Do you do it in tranches? Are there ever times where you just liquidate the position and ring the register? How do you deal with selling the winners?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think it's very nuanced. I think one important differentiation to make right off the bat is whether you're valuing your holdings. And I think all investors should have a number in mind for each and every one of their holdings for what they think fair or expected value is. So for producers, royalty companies, you know, maybe later stage developers, you can have a little better sense of what fair value is. Basically what the company is worth all else equal, and if you see a significant delta between the current price and what you deem to be fair value, most often using discounted cash flow analysis, one could in some circumstances, maybe amongst the royalty names, use an approximation of relative value to determine this figure. But what is the delta between price and value? And ultimately, as the price goes up, unless there's been a step change development at the company that's changed that figure, every cent that goes up, the company is that much less attractive. But for those types of fair value stories, I'm a little more comfortable. And Neo is an example of a company where I think you can reasonably come to a fair value. I'm a little more comfortable holding that position up until it reaches fair value. And at that point, I will certainly start taking profits. I won't necessarily sell instinctively immediately. Oftentimes, you'll see companies overshoot fair value, but certainly start aggressively selling. And then in the case of an overshoot, you can perhaps exit at an average cost that is above what you deem fair value. But I think if you look at the earlier stage companies, the explorers, it's very difficult. You can't estimate a fair value. You have to look at expected value, which is certainly more of an art than a science. And I think if you have a drill play and you have a certain expected value in mind, even if the company is trading at a significant discount, maybe you have, you know, hypothetically a fair value of $1 per share in mind, the company or expected value, excuse me, of $1 per share in mind, and the company's trading at 30 cents. Sure, the company would have to roughly triple from current levels to reach what your expected value is. But because of the inherent uncertainty of an expected value calculation, particularly for early stage explorers, I am much more willing to take profits when the company's share price moves, particularly if that move is not driven by a fundamental catalyst. So maybe this hypothetical company at 30 cents comes out with a great drill result and it moves up to 60 cents. That would be a reason to stand pat. But if you see that same company move up to 50 or 60 cents purely on the anticipation of an upcoming drill program, or purely on a change in sentiment in the broader market, even though in my mind at 50 or 60 cents, it's still trading at a significant value to what I've determined expected value to be, I am much more willing to take capital off the table. And I think in many of these situations, when the company's moving not on a fundamental development, but rather on excitement about upcoming programs or upcoming news flow, that's a good opportunity to de-risk. And, you know, in a best case scenario, take your entire cost basis off the table. So at that point, you're playing with the house's money. So, yeah, from a high level, I think as you think through this for the individual positions in your portfolio, I think it can be helpful to differentiate which of the companies, again, generally later stage, do you actually have a firm fair value in mind? And which of them do you have a rougher approximation of expected value and then act accordingly?
Fair enough. That also ties in with some of the smaller companies, right, that do need that news. And you also need to factor in dilution, too. So sometimes look at the share price, but also factor in what the market cap is and what it'll take to get there. But hey, right now, Matt, there's a lot of stocks that are performing very well in especially the precious metals sector. So hopefully our listeners are enjoying that wave of winners. They're taking part in it. And yeah, trim, take some gains, but also this is a time to be invested in this sector as these share prices move up and as money filters a bit more even down the food chain. All right, again, Matt Geiger, managing partner at MJG Capital. Always fascinating to hear what you are doing within the portfolio, Matt. Thank you very much for your time. And everybody, thanks for tuning in to this weekend show. As always, go back to our website, podcast, YouTube channel, and our new Substack page to check out all our daily editorials and company updates from throughout the week, and keep in touch with Shad and I through email. Everyone, thanks for tuning in. I hope you all have a great rest of your weekend.
The Corlin Economics Report is produced for A.B. Corlin and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.